Hello and welcome back to the podcast that is always up to speed with Formula One here on the Overtime Media Network. Mark and Mark, Daly and Hamilton here to talk not about the U.S. political situation, which we've been talking about among ourselves quite substantially for the past couple of days, and quite rightly so. But amidst all the serious and heavy things that are happening in the world, we're here to talk about Formula One and distract a little bit from all this here I am trying to say that we're going to talk about distracting ourselves, and the first thing we're going to talk about is the possibility of the delay of the start to the Formula One season. So who am I kidding? But anyways, Mark, how are you this week? The first real show of 2021. It's here. It's happening.
Yeah, we got 5-6 days into 2021 before it would seem the year's already becoming somewhat shattered. And you know, and I think you made a great point there where we could probably talk about what's happened in the U.S. for 15 or 20 minutes. And I don't think by any means we are trying to be disingenuous by not digging into this. But I think at the end of the day, there's probably subject matter experts out there that can speak to the circumstances and the experiences with much greater authority than we can. And I think what we can do is we can continue to provide a fun, upbeat escape from some of the realities of the world right now, whether it's the chaos at the Capitol in Washington, D.C., or the COVID situation. So I think for us, it's a good opportunity. And you're right, like this year has been a struggle so far, and we're 5 or 6 days in. But that said, if you only want to open up any one of a million F1 blogs, there's so much stuff going on already. And, you know, the last 3, 4, 5, 6 weeks, we've been very, very excited about the potential or the prospect of a 23 race calendar in Formula One. And I think the sport's obviously very ambitious, and I think they're excited about the prospect that most of these countries can start deploying and rolling out the vaccine at a fairly rapid race. But I think what we're likely to see already is that the Australian GP, which is typically the bellwether, the event that kicks off the Formula One campaign, is likely to be delayed until much, much, much later in the season. And, you know, when you think about it, right, we're now close to the middle of January. This is a race that happens in the middle of March. Like, we're really just 50, 60 days away from when that race would typically happen. And I know you and I talked about this a little bit the last couple of weeks, and we were just purely speculating, but we were really thinking about the logistical challenges that if that race is going to happen, they both need to start selling tickets, which they haven't done, and they need to start building the track, because this is a temporary track built in and around city streets in a park in the heart of Melbourne, and none of that's happened. And I think the other concern is that even if logistically they could do that, and even if the health authorities in that state in Australia were comfortable selling some tickets, because that's the only way this could be viable, right? Like, to put together a track for a single weekend only works if you're selling tickets because you need the associated revenue. Even if they were comfortable doing that, are they also comfortable flying in 7 teams that are based out of the UK, which is being absolutely ravaged by the virus right now? And there has been no official announcement out of the race organizers, but you and I were talking earlier today about the fact that there's a number of blogs reporting that this race is going to be postponed. It will likely be pushed later into the season. And it's also being reported that on a Zoom call, new Formula One boss Stefano Domenicali has already shared with teams a prospective new calendar. So it's, I think F1 is being very, very, I want to say not reactive. I think they're trying to be the opposite of reactive. And rather than wait until they're in a position where they have to make a last minute call, they're being very, very, very forward thinking with what might need to happen with this calendar. So the good news is that they may be able to save the Australian race at this point. And again, this is purely reporting through a number of different F1 sources, but it's likely that Australia could get pushed off till the end of November, sandwiched between the Brazilian Grand Prix and the new Saudi Arabian GP. But the good news is, and we already knew that there was an open race slot, because when Vietnam backed out, they never backfilled it. And you'd made a really great observation last week or the week before about the fact that that could be a great slot for Portugal, because it would precede Spain, and geographically, logistically, it would work. So again, none of this has been confirmed by F1, but the rumors at this point are that the season will start in Bahrain, that preseason testing will be moved from Spain to Bahrain, because logistically there's some significant savings there, and then that race will be followed by Imola and then Portugal. So already the schedule is in a state of flux and it's very, very fluid. But we could potentially see some tracks that we really enjoyed seeing last year. So that might be the positive outcome of all of this.
Yeah, absolutely. And excuse me, I'm not choking up here. It's I'm not getting emotional about the potential of a disruption to the start of the season. But, you know, I think it totally makes sense that regardless if this gets confirmed one way or another, that it's going to surface at some point during the year. And Jean Todt, president of the FIA, said as much earlier this week. And I think we just have to face that fact that regardless that just a week ago, we had all this optimism going into a new year that things were going to change, which obviously is a little bit overly optimistic. But I think until the virus gets brought under control, until more people are getting vaccinated, until the numbers start going down rather than up, that it really is going to be a holdover from last season. And I think we just have to be prepared for that. But it does make a lot of sense to push that later into the year. Of course, you know, going into the what we call the winter months in the Northern Hemisphere is obviously the reverse in the Southern Hemisphere at that time of the year. It makes sense to sandwich it in between Brazil and Saudi Arabia because, well, they're not all that close to either of those two countries, but at least you're in the right hemisphere. So, I mean, logistically, it partially makes sense. And then also, you don't lose it completely. So that would be a great thing. And then also moving the testing from Spain to Bahrain. Again, that makes it, you know, like you say, I mean, logistically, it makes sense. It also makes sense for the F1 bubble because they can come in, they can stay at the track, they can do what they need to do to stay separated. And then, of course, once they're in there and then hopefully, you know, everybody's staying healthy, nobody's testing positive for COVID, they can just go from one thing into another and then, you know, move the F1 circus back to Europe, go to Imola, then maybe Portimao and then go from there. And, like you say, I mean, it is going to be in a state of flux, and I think we just need to be sit back and just to kind of roll with the punches, because I very much as you said, I don't think this is a bad thing. I think it's better for them to be out front and ahead of it and being proactive rather than reactive, and kind of scrambling to make changes when things are sort of rapidly falling apart around them, like it happened last year in Melbourne. And that now we know that the success of the bubble worked by and large with the relatively small number of test positive cases that we saw in 2020. And it's just a matter of going to places, I think, where they can contain themselves. And also it makes sense, you know, in this climate that we're living in with COVID everywhere, does it really make sense to go and start the season off at a place where, you know, you have to build a temporary track? I mean, it makes a lot more sense to try and go somewhere else that's completely ready. I mean, it was just like MLS said, even before they were confirmed for last season, was, you know, we need a couple of weeks max to get this thing set up, because basically we don't have to worry about the infrastructure for 100,000 people. We don't need to worry about food, catering, toilets, parking, all these things that you need for all these fans. It's just basically get your people in here. We'll sort out the facilities and then the media stuff, and that's about it. And that's by and large why I think it was so successful, the 2020 season.
You completely nailed it. And I think the races that are going to potentially be at risk, and I think the good news is that if you look at the anticipated rollout timelines for the vaccine in most of the countries that F1 is going to visit on the calendar this year, I would suggest and I would believe that most of the population of these countries, if everything goes well, will probably have a vaccine available to them by the time we get to June or July. So you got to think the back half of the schedule is going to be much more secure than the front half. And even in the front half, and you made a terrific point, like the races really that potentially could be at risk would be races like Australia, because it's not a purpose-built track. It's in the center of a metropolitan space, and there's huge risk of bringing in thousands of people associated with the F1 race and then potentially exposing the local public, and no local health authority is going to tolerate that. So there's significant risk there. I was talking to someone a couple of days ago because I was also very curious about Canada. And Canada's still obviously 3, 4, 5 months out. It's on June 13th. But for those of you outside of Canada, Quebec is currently experiencing the strictest lockdown measures of anywhere in Canada. So it's a complete lockdown. There's no social mixing whatsoever. All but the most essential retail is closed. And they've actually also instituted now an 8 p.m. curfew with fines between $1,000 and $6,000 if you're fined to violate those curfew times. So Quebec is in a very, very, very strict lockdown state. And I was talking to somebody, not that works directly for the race organizers, but is very close to them. And their point was, look, the race is on the calendar, not because the province and the city of Montreal and the health authorities have signed off, but rather because it's contractually on the calendar, that the race organizers have a contract with the city and the province to host that race. But that said, ultimately, whether it happens or not will be up to local health authorities. So again, I think Montreal is a little bit on the bubble, and you have to think Monaco as well is in a tough space because, again, that's a race that takes place in an incredibly dense city, requires months of prep to build out that track. But I think to your earlier point that Imola, I think that is a ready-to-go race, especially if there aren't fans attending. You can get that ready in 2 weeks. And, you know, I was talking to some of the folks that work on the organizing board for the British Grand Prix, and they were talking about the races this year relative to any other race they've done before, that ultimately, one of the hardest parts of hosting a race weekend is managing the hundreds of thousands of people that come through the gates. The parking, the security, the food, the washrooms, all of that is incredibly complex. But if you back that out and you're talking about a purpose-built track that is miles or hundreds of miles away from any urban center, that's really doable. And if they could do it last year, I'm very confident they can do it this year. I just think some of those tracks that are kind of temporary in city centers, they're probably the ones that are going to be at risk. But I think the back half of the schedule will probably be a little bit more secure, but I think the front half will be a little bit more fluid. But Formula One also built some safety mechanisms in, right? They left that Vietnam slot empty, and there's some space. And then the only other thing, and then again, this is being reported, but I haven't been able to find anything to substantiate the explanation, is that China itself is probably at risk, the Chinese Grand Prix. And the principal concern there is, and you made a great point, that China is doing a fantastic job of managing the virus situation. And it's also a little bit different and a little bit easier for an authoritarian state that doesn't necessarily get pushback from the media and its population. Yeah. But ultimately, they're doing a terrific job. But ultimately, they're not in a position where they want to risk, again, bringing in thousands of Formula One staffers, most of whom are based in the UK. So
yeah.
So it'll be interesting. I think it'll give us a lot to talk about over the coming weeks and months.
Well, certainly. I mean, if you look at like some of the races that are on the calendar for this year, I mean, Monaco, Azerbaijan, Canada, Singapore, and even Mexico City. I mean, Mexico City might be a purpose-built track, but I mean, Mexico City is a very densely populated. I mean, it's not like Spielberg at the Red Bull Ring, right? I mean, it's not like you can fly into. Because isn't there like a military airfield close by that they could fly into or something? And then basically, I mean, that's almost ideal for this situation. Then they almost sequestered themselves at Spielberg for 2 weeks. Unless you're Valtteri Bottas and Charles Leclerc and you fly home to Monaco in between. But yeah, exactly, right? And then come back, 10 days or whatever it is later. But yeah, certainly it's going to be in a state of flux for sure. But it is just the sign of the times that we're living in. And I thought you made a really good point when we were talking over the holiday. And just over the coming weeks and months is still probably going to be, you know, more of the same. And, you know, slowly but surely, hopefully, of course, you know, crossing fingers here that that the tide will slowly turn and the constant barrage of bad news will slowly become good news as we can hopefully finally get a handle on this thing and, people get vaccinated and hopefully these numbers start coming down sooner rather than later. But I mean, certainly in the Northern Hemisphere, this is, typically when we see the time of year where we see a lot of respiratory illness anyways, being cold or flu anyways, because the weather's crap and we're all indoors and, we're spending lots of time either at the office at home and, kids are getting, cold and flu at school and then, it just goes around. So something, quite nasty like COVID, it just thrives in a situation like that. But anyways, let's take a quick break here. And on the other side, we'll come back. We've got lots of things to talk about this week. And we're going to go back and revisit something we've been talking about. And that's the youth revolution in Formula One. And we'll do so in just a moment here after we take a break here on the Overtime Media Network. So please don't go away. We'll be back in just a moment. Passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Have you ever experienced turbulence on a flight and wondered why?
And you can see all the terrain around you. You've got no issue with visibility or anything?
No, everything's peachy.
Maybe you've sat on the tarmac for hours wondering why your plane isn't moving.
Well, we're outside here. They're saying the ramp is closed. They won't let us park because of Air Force One.
Listen in on the conversations between pilots and air traffic controllers on the Air Traffic Out of Control podcast.
5-1-0, declaring an emergency. There's smoke in the cabin. I need to make a landing right now on 31 left.
We have the most interesting, wild, and funny ATC recordings you will ever hear. Check out Air Traffic Out of Control wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
All right. Well, welcome back to the show and welcome to all of you listening into the podcast on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. And those of you watching the video on YouTube, welcome to one and all. Mark and Mark here talking about, what we do every week, and that's Formula One. Pleasant distraction from all the heavy stuff that's going on out there. And again, this is a bit of a weird one. I wanted to talk about Lando Norris. I mean, there's a couple of things going around, but the first thing I didn't expect to see earlier this week is when I got up in the morning, start to doom scrolling through my Twitter feed, and then one of the first things that pops up, I mean this is before the whole situation in DC unfolded, there was the first thing that kind of shocked me and then was soon forgotten, obviously, was the news that poor old Lando Norris is the latest Formula One driver to test positive for COVID. Fortunately, he's feeling well, but he was actually in Abu Dhabi. He was there on a holiday just before a training camp and before the start of the season. He reported a loss of smell and taste, which is one of the ways that that a COVID manifests itself. He took a test. He tested positive, and he's now self-isolating, sheltering in place, whatever you want to call it, at his hotel in Abu Dhabi. And fortunately, apart from the loss of smell and taste, he's he's feeling well. He's not reporting any other symptoms, and he's just the latest in the fourth driver after Lance Norris. I'm getting my L name drivers mixed up. Lance Stroll, Checo Perez, and most notably seven-time world champion Lewis Hamilton. So that was a real surprise, and hopefully he's back in shape pretty quick here.
Yeah, I'm very, very excited to see this kid once again this year. I think he's obviously had a really great start to his Formula One career. This is a kid who won the Formula 3 championship in 17, finished runner-up to George Russell in the F2 championship in 2018. So he clearly, even before he arrived in the championship into Formula One, has demonstrated that he can win at the highest levels. I think what I like about him is, one, besides the fact that he's very personable, he's very charismatic, he's great on social media, I absolutely adored watching the relationship between he and Carlos Sainz the last couple of years. I think sometimes there's friction or animosity between two drivers. I love to see them joke in the paddock. They played with each other. They joked. There was practical hijinks. It was great to see. And it was also great to see Lando develop as a driver between 2018 and 2019. He finished 11th in the World Championship in 2019. He improved to 9th this year, but it was more his consistency, right? Like, he had the one podium in Austria this year to begin the season, but he was close on four or five other occasions. And I just think that as he continues to improve and he continues to refine his racecraft, and now the fact that his car is going to be paired with a Mercedes power unit, I think the sky potentially is the limit for him. And you know, I think it's disappointing that obviously he's not going to be paired with Carlos Sainz, and that dynamic, that relationship is going to end. But you're not bringing in Daniel Ricciardo, who himself is an absolutely phenomenal personality and kind of a marketing sensation. So I'm equally as excited to see what those two are like together, both on and off the track. But yeah, I was disappointed to hear he kind of contracted COVID. And I guess that would that be the fourth driver now? Yeah. We're talking Sergio, Lance, Lewis, and...
And now Lando, yeah.
You're, so you're 20% of the grid has now been exposed to the virus, or at least has had the virus contracted. But I'm looking forward to seeing him this year. And again, he's part of that youth wave that we talk so much about, the George Russells and the Lance Strolls and the Nicholas Latifis. But again, this young Brit is a rock star, and I think he has a very bright future in front of him.
Yeah, absolutely. I think he's an interesting case because, I mean, obviously they knew what they had in Lando Norris, because a couple of years ago, before he was actually confirmed as a McLaren driver, I don't know if you remember this at the time, but Franz Tost, the team principal at Toro Rosso, actually he'd come out and said that he wanted to see if they could broker some sort of deal and replace Brendan Hartley for the remainder of 2018 and then all of 2019 on some sort of loan deal. And Zach Brown, CEO of McLaren, flat out said, no, we want to get this kid into our car ASAP. And then it wasn't too much longer before he was confirmed for the 2019 season. And it was pretty obvious that that there was something to him. But I mean, for me, the one race, the one moment that really kind of confirmed that he's a legit driver in his rookie season was in France, when he had that, a hydraulic problem or something, hydraulics, electrics, whatever it was, late in the race. And somehow he still managed to manhandle the car around. Finished in the points when it looked like he might just drop out after having a very strong race. And I thought, well, there's something to this guy. I mean, I can see now why they were, very reticent to let him go even on a temporary basis to Toro Rosso. And I mean, he's just gone from strength to strength. I mean, obviously the car has been slowly improving. And like you say, the prospect now, or the opportunity that we're going to see him paired with the McLaren and Mercedes power, and then having, a teammate of the ilk of Danny Ricciardo, I think it's going to be a very exciting season to watch. I mean, a couple of years ago, to think that this might be a team that, forget top five in the constructors. I mean, that didn't even seem like a possibility even as recently as maybe 3 years ago, definitely. But I mean, they've really bounced back rather impressively after being, the doldrums is, I think, a really kind way of putting it. So, like you say, I mean, it's going to be really exciting to watch him paired with Danny Ricciardo, which I see a lot of synergy, both, as teammates, in and out of the car. I think that I think they've got a good thing going. I think that regardless where you are in the McLaren organization, regardless if you're somebody that's part of the racing operations or you're in the office doing the social media, doing the marketing or whatever, I think that regardless what your job is within that team right now, I think you're excited looking ahead to this year.
You know, I've heard this from so many drivers in the past when they're asked about entering the sport. And as far as the drivers are concerned, it's just... it's critical that you accept whatever seat comes your way. So if it's a Williams or if it's a Sauber or a Toro Rosso, you know what? Beggars can't be choosers. And if you don't take that opportunity, there just may never be an opportunity. And I think that's sometimes why some of these very talented young drivers jump at these lower ranked teams. But I still recall very much in the middle of 2018 when there was all the speculation about what could potentially happen and could he be joining an F1 team that year. And I just remember thinking like that could ultimately be incredibly damaging to his career, that this is a kid that's clearly very capable. And I didn't have trust that team that you mentioned would necessarily be able to nurture him, or mm-hmm. that they were going to provide him with a car that would be capable of demonstrating what his true talents are. And I was very, very relieved as that season went on that he assumed the test driver role with McLaren, got some exposure to that team, spent some time around the paddock, and that ultimately he was promoted to that team in 2019. I think that's the best thing that could have happened. And I think what we're seeing is that McLaren, free of the distraction of Alonso, is really, really great at building team chemistry and nurturing their young drivers. And it's just, it's remarkable where this team has come from. And maybe it speaks to just how destructive an influence and a really angry Alonso can be with an underperforming power unit. Yeah. But this team, both from a performance perspective and from a culture and chemistry perspective, just seems to be in a completely different stratosphere. And to your point, like, I wasn't expecting a top five finish this year, let alone, and again, there's some mitigating circumstances that
certainly
helped promote them to third in the championship, but ultimately they finished third in the championship. And there's really no reason to think that couldn't happen again in 2021, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's funny when you were just talking about him, Lando, and that last series of thoughts there, that, you know, I think what's really remarkable is the fact is that they have, you know, improved so drastically over the past couple of years. Because, you know, as you were talking about that, I was starting to think, well, if they had not improved, would he be another kind of a George Russell-esque kind of driver, thinking, well, you know, this guy had so much promise before he got into Formula One, and would we be talking about him, you know, sort of in a similar breath as George Russell? I mean, the conversation on George has been completely reset after, you know, filling in at Mercedes for Lewis at Bahrain 2 there at the end of the season. I mean, I think he's obviously proven what a legit driver he is, and that he's also a driver to look at for the future. And it really is fascinating when you look now at the number of young drivers that we see on the grid, but not only just young drivers, but drivers that are with good teams. I mean, you look at Lando, obviously you look at Max, you look at Charles Leclerc. I mean, the list keeps going on and on and on. And, you know, I think that's why, you know, as unfortunate that it was that Lewis had to miss a race because of COVID, and fortunately he never really got, very sick at all, that there was a silver lining to that cloud, and that was George Russell, because we were like, well, let's see how it turns out in practice. I mean, he goes into FP1 and almost right from the very first moment, he goes in, starts blowing people's minds and really says surprising. It was really quite shocking, like, how good he was in each and every session that he was in that car. And it would have been an absolute tragedy if with all the misfortune suffered during the race, that after the win started to slip away, that then the podium started to slip away, if he had not at least finished in the points, I think we would have all just collectively, as fans of Formula One, would have just felt so ultimately cheated that this guy that, didn't get a point. Obviously, he didn't score that many, but it was something.
Yeah, it really shows how, and I think we've been able to speculate about this the past couple of years, but it really shows how handicapped or handcuffed those drivers are on that Williams team. And, you know, if I'm George Russell, imagine if, and again, I don't want to take anything away from Lando, because I think he's done a great job with that package and that car. But I just think if I'm George Russell, like, I've got to be looking at envy with drivers like Lando Norris that are blessed to be a part of teams. And again, there's circumstances, you know, Lando was obviously a McLaren driver. He had a great relationship with Zach Brown, and George Russell is a Mercedes driver, and circumstance led him to the Williams team. But man, if I was George Russell, I would be looking with such envy at that McLaren team, particularly since they themselves are going to be a Mercedes powered team next year. But you're right. I can't get over the good fortune that we have as fans of this sport with this younger crop of drivers. The one thing, and I'm calling it now, is I think by mid-season, the rumor mill surrounding where George Russell will be in 2022 will be at a fever pitch. I don't think there is any circumstance under which he can be back at Williams for a fourth season. I don't think that's a possibility. I think he's either, again, this is purely speculation at this point, but I think the fever pitch will be that he's either going to find his way into Mercedes, or Mercedes is going to cut him loose and let him explore other opportunities. But mark my words, by mid-season, it'll be a fever pitch in terms of rumor mill surrounding the future of George Russell, if it hasn't been formally announced by that point.
Yeah, you know, it'll be really interesting. I think one of the first indications of where he might land will be, what is the status between Mercedes and Mr. One-Year Contract, Valtteri Bottas, right? I mean, you know, no criticism against him. I mean, he's done everything that they wanted him to do since he landed there in 2017. But if it sort of comes out that, there's no planned contract discussions between Valtteri and Mercedes, then, it's a bit obviously speculative, but you have to think at some point, well, you know, if these two aren't getting together to talk about another contract, then perhaps maybe that might be an indication that they're looking to maybe bring George in. Because, I mean, if you're George and you're coming into Mercedes and, you know, even if you get a couple of like a season or two with Lewis, I mean, obviously that still needs to be confirmed and that needs to get sorted out, which with it probably will, you know, in the coming weeks or before that deal's done, that, you know, that would be the best situation if you're a guy like George Russell, you know, be the heir apparent to Lewis Hamilton and Mercedes. But yeah, I was just sort of thinking too that if you're either George Russell or Nick Latifi, you must be really, you know, really kind of concerned and frustrated because you know you've got the best engine in Formula One behind you, but what's underneath you leaves a lot to be desired. But when you look at McLaren, and of course we're going to be looking very, very close at them, how they're going to do next season with Mercedes power. But look what Aston Martin has done, and as Racing Point, especially last season with the pink Mercedes. I mean, that was a huge quantum leap forward, and you know you got to be thinking, you know, like if you're George Russell or Nick, you got to be thinking, well, you know, this is a team sort of similar size, well, actually probably smaller in terms of resources and, well, formerly, of course, and also personnel in the factory and the team itself, that you know, with everything that Williams has behind it, how come we can't be playing on the same level as Racing Point? So anyway, so there's certainly so many things to look at, you know, for next, or I keep saying next season. Next season is actually this season now, right?
Two months.
Yeah, I know, certainly. Anyway, so let's take another break here quickly, Mark, and we'll come back and still plenty of things to talk about, and we will do so just here on the other side of the break, so don't go away. We'll be back in just a moment. All right, well, welcome back to the show, and we've been talking about the youth revolution. We've been talking about, well, talking about pretty much everything. We've also been talking about you know, the potential for a delay to the start to the season. But there was another interesting story that came out. Was Danny Ricciardo was talking in the media this week just about the experience that he had with an inconclusive COVID test before the Russian Grand Prix. And he actually, the word that he used was panic before he was actually cleared and the results came back negative. Gosh, you know, like it must be something. I mean, most people obviously do not need to go and get a COVID test unless they actually feel, you know, sick and, you know, they're experiencing some symptoms. I mean, obviously, some people need to get them more often, and, you know, people obviously working in Formula One need to provide a negative test. But he did have the following to say, and it was a quote: "I actually did wake up one morning with an inconclusive result. I had a scare at like 6 a.m. one morning. I was trying to figure it out, and I had to get tested again. There was a bit of a panic, and that wasn't fun." End quote. And yeah, you know, unfortunately, I think a lot of us have had to deal with that. I mean, you know, some, you know, family members and, you know, some of my neighbors and what they've had to go and get them. Fortunately, they all came back clear, but it's tense moments, you know. It's not a fun thing to experience.
Yeah, and I got to think, though, that for a Formula One driver, again, it's probably terrifying for anyone to go through that process. And I think at this point, most of us have had a COVID-19 test. Actually, fortunately, I haven't been in a situation where I've needed to, but my coworkers have, my boss has, my wife has. It's not pleasant. And then once the COVID test is done, the hard part is waiting for the results ultimately. And I think what makes it even tougher for the Formula One driver, though, is their entire, and obviously family is important, but the 20 races or the 22 races or last season, and the 17 races on the calendar mean everything to him. And I think for him, it's partly, hey, am I sick? Did I expose other people? Did I expose my family? Am I going to be sick? How is this going to turn out? But I think it's also that sheer panic of knowing that I could potentially miss a Grand Prix. And again, these guys are built and hardwired and kind of manufactured from the ground up to be professional racing drivers. And I think in his case, and he never said this, so I'm kind of putting words in his mouth, but I got to think part of that panic and that fear is the anxiety associated with missing a Grand Prix. And no racer wants to miss a race, especially when, you know, I've tested positive. Maybe I feel some symptoms. Maybe I don't. I think it's just very hard for them to sit and watch somebody else get fitted for their race car. Like, I think that's incredibly difficult. And again, I'm putting words in his mouth, but I'm trying to put myself into the mindset of a Formula One driver days before a Grand Prix in Russia. So I think obviously there's all the fear in the world about the health aspects and who else did I potentially expose to this and all those kind of pieces. But I think it's also that anxiety about not being in my car on the race day itself.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting that you should say that. And I mean, I'm not familiar with dealing with Formula One drivers on a regular basis, but professional soccer players, you know, I've dealt with constantly for a number of years, and there is a real palpable sense of that if I miss this one game or
absolutely
miss five games or whatever it is because I hurt myself, that, you know, there is a legitimate fear that these you know, people have, regardless men or women at any level, you know, especially the higher elite levels, that if you miss a game or two or three or whatever it is, you know, there's a real fear, you know, unspoken or not, that they, you know, they'll lose their spot in the team. You know, I mean, Formula One's a little bit different, but still, you know, there's that fear that somebody else is going to come in and take your spot and do your job and do it better, and that you'll quickly become, you know, an afterthought.
Your absence is somebody else's audition.
Yes,
and I think you're right. Whether we like it or not, professional sports, it's a pretty cutthroat industry, and teams, yeah, obviously, the best interest of the team is to put a winning product on the field, and Formula One is no different. And I think this is obviously the case here, where you never want to lose your seat and see, and again, these guys aren't cheering against somebody else, but obviously they want to be the one in that seat. And I think it was probably, and we talked a lot about this a couple of weeks ago, it was, as much as Lewis is a phenomenal personality, I don't think it was necessarily in his interest to watch Russell sit in his car and potentially win that race, because that opens up all kinds of dialogues about how good is he versus how great is this car. And fortunately, the narrative played out a little bit differently. But again, it's that same situation. But I think you're absolutely right, and that soccer analogy is brilliant. To miss three or four or five games and give somebody else the opportunity to audition in your place is incredibly challenging for those folks. And it makes rehab that much more difficult. And it's a little bit different in North America when we talk about the NBA and the NHL and Major League Baseball, where you have guaranteed contracts. But
yes,
in soccer and those sports where they have shorter contracts, they're not necessarily guaranteed. It's extremely cutthroat.
Yeah. And it is interesting, too, also just going back to the mentality, sort of the mental part of it, too, like when these athletes deal with injury setbacks, whatever it is. And it's so funny. It's just the way, like you said, like these elite athletes are wired, you know, from the ground up, is that when they get hurt, it's just like, oh, I'll train harder, or I'll rehab harder, I'll do more physio or something.
Yeah,
but then absolutely, when it comes to something like COVID, when you have to sit there for 10 or 14 days and self-isolate, and you do, there's nothing you can do, right? It's just like you have to sit there and basically fret and worry about, are more symptoms going to manifest as, oh no, like my throat's getting a little itchy, I'm sneezing, oh, I feel a little bit, you know, you get all these, you know, also become psychosomatic, and it's like, you know, you can't go out, you can't go for another extra hour on the bike, you can't go for an extra hard session in the gym, you have to sit there until you either become sick and you need to get treatment for it, or you just have to ride it out, or, you know, you sit there for the, you know, the minimum amount of time and go and get retested, and either, you know, depending on the result of that, you're either cleared or you kind of go back into that holding pattern again.
I love your soccer analogy, because one of the things that we always look for when a soccer player or football player comes back from an injury, we always look to see how long it takes them to get their fitness back. And we're not like their knee, their elbow, that's healed, but how long does it take to them to get back into the same level of cardiovascular health that they were in before? And I think one of the things that we don't want to discount with an F1 driver, and I think a lot of people do, is these are supremely fit athletes. Yeah. And the amount of time that they spend on the treadmill, on the bike, in the gym, running, doing stairs is absurd. They're supremely fit athletes. And in this case, if I have an infection, to be sitting in a room, to your point, for 7 or 10 or 14 days, I'm not only away from my team and I'm not only not socializing, but my fitness is eroding around me. And mm-hmm. then when I do finally test negative, I need to work that much harder to get back to where I was 2 weeks ago, right?
Yeah, and I think it's more to that point too, is I think we did see that manifested to a certain degree at Abu Dhabi when Lewis came back for that last race of the year. Of course, there were some issues that Mercedes were dealing with mechanically with the cars, that they weren't able to push them as hard as possible. But Lewis, I don't want to say he was a non-factor, because that's, you know, I think a little bit cruel, but he wasn't as sharp and as on point as we expect to see Lewis, you know, each and every race, right? I mean, he did as much say that, you know, he was feeling the after effects. I mean, he was a little bit ill. It wasn't super nasty, of course, but, you know, the fact was he had to isolate for, you know, 10 days or 14 days or whatever it was, and he was ill to a certain degree. And yeah, I mean, the thing is, if you're not training at that peak level, and of course over the off season they take their time off and they relax, and but you know that is very short. I mean, the guarantee that these guys are out there right now just killing it each and every day. Absolutely. And working up so that when we get to, well, possibly Australia in about about 8 weeks from now, that they are at that peak, that it's going to build up in a crescendo. And, you know, 1 day, 2 days, I mean, if you or I miss a day or two, I mean, away from our regular workouts, or go get on the bike or go for a run, we'll get a little bit cranky, right? But yeah. I mean, we're not going to notice a huge difference in terms of performance the next time we go out. But these guys that are training as much as they're in the simulator and doing all these other things, that's a big deal to miss a couple of days and then be sick on top of it.
I was going to reference as well, and this is probably a little bit disingenuous, because he retired in the two races prior to his COVID test, but Lance Stroll coming back from his COVID infection, retirement in Portugal, a 13th place, a 9th place, another retirement before bouncing back with that podium in Sakhir. And again, he could have just been in a slump period, but yeah. I think what we see there is obviously he struggled post-infection. Yeah. Now, Sergio, on the other hand, a 5th place, a 10th, and a 10th. So I don't know what you can necessarily take from this, but I think you're right that there's both a fitness element to this, but probably also very much a mental element as well. And the anxiety that builds up of being isolated and understanding how much work you need to do to get back, to get your fitness back and to get your seat. And then also the concern about the fact that somebody else is auditioning in your car. And then in some of these drivers' cases, and Daniel was good because he already had a contract stood up for McLaren for the subsequent season. Mm-hmm. But if you're one of these drivers that doesn't necessarily have a contract the next year, you know what? The anxiety is amplified that much more.
Yeah. When you're on the bubble like that and you're basically out there each and every lap is an audition for potentially a new contract for the next season. I mean, the stress is real. I mean, yeah. You're going to be feeling it each and every time. But I mean, I think for Lance, a lot of it was just, he seemed like he was snake bitten last year. It seemed that it was just not going right for him. I think it was perfectly summed up. I mean, as good as he looked in Turkey, and my gosh, he should have done obviously a lot better in that race compared to where he finished up. But I thought that, you know, especially the second half of his season was summed up perfectly at the first Bahrain Grand Prix, was after all that drama that went on. You know, Kvyat, who's obviously in a bit of a different headspace after being, you know, inadvertently and unintentionally involved in the whole Grosjean incident, you know, even though at that point they knew that that he was okay after that horrible accident. I mean, somewhere in the back of your mind, you know that you're not 100% on your game, and you could just kind of tell the way that that coming together that he had with Lance, that low speed accident that was just enough to flip Lance upside down and land on his roll bar, kind of for me, kind of summed it up in a nutshell. I thought at this point, I was thinking, if I'm Lance Stroll, I said, I just want to get to Abu Dhabi. I want to go home. I want to forget about this this season and just get away for a couple of weeks and then come back and then just go at it hard for 2021.
I don't know if you saw, but Andrew Benson for the BBC has mm-hmm. done a really great interview with Lawrence Stroll. There's some really, really, really good stuff in there. And he goes into tremendous detail about Vettel and I don't want to suggest he's making excuses for Vettel, but he does a lot to rationalize Vettel's experiences and performances this year. And also talks about the fact that, look, you know what? Vettel really struggled in 2014 before he migrated to Ferrari with a car that wasn't necessarily built for him. But he spoke pretty glowingly about Lance. He spoke to the fact that, you know, as a 21-year-old driver, his performance last year, despite all of the misfortune, was extremely impressive. He does acknowledge, to your points as well, that Lance had a real string of bad luck last year. But his sense and his belief is that pairing him with Vettel, giving him the exposure to Vettel, the continued development of the team, the fact that they're going to be opening their new factory shortly, the injection of additional capital that's going to come with their, and I don't know if we're going to talk about it today, but obviously the injection of additional capital that's going to come with their new principal sponsor is going to put them into a really, really good position for 2021. But I also think that, you know what, Lance has had a bit of a free ride the last couple of years. Obviously, last year was his first year in this car, and it was a bit of a hybrid between a 2018 and a 2019 car. And they had a series of different kind of catch-up revisions throughout the year. This year, you know, he looked good in the first half of the season, and he had a couple of flashes in the back half, but I think the pressure will be on him pretty significantly next year if these misfortunes continue to happen, if you know what I mean. Like, he can't have four or five retirements this coming season without an additional level of scrutiny upon him. And, you know, he's done such a great job of these flashes, whether it's Italy in 2017, or whether it's qualifying in Turkey and then the misfortune of having the wing damage, or whether it's a couple of podiums this year. Like, there's these flashes, but he needs to find a way to string this together throughout the course of an entire calendar. And I think when we talk about our preview for 2021, I think one of the things that I'm going to be looking at most closely is, can Lance string together a really strong calendar? Because we've seen it in chunks. We've seen these one-offs. So it'll be very, very, very interesting to see. And it'll be interesting to see as well whether he can learn or pick up any of the behaviors that Sebastian Vettel has. And I still strongly believe that Lawrence Stroll brought in Vettel because, one, it's a marketing play, right? Like, if you're going to invest this amount of money in this team and you're going to take on a significant ownership in Aston Martin so you can borrow the branding and you can stand up this works team, obviously you want to be able to have a world champion there. But I think Lawrence's long-term vision, short-term vision, medium-term vision isn't necessarily to make Vettel a world champion, but it's to make Lance a world champion. And I think he wants to expose Lance to somebody that's been there, has been to the top of the mountain, has faced all of those challenges. And I think that's what he wants. And I'll be very curious to see what Lance learns from Vettel, but I want to see what their relationship is like. I think we all know that the relationship between Lance and Felipe Massa was non-existent. And I think Lance was very open about that because I think a lot of people thought that, you know what, Felipe, you know, his last season, is he going to bring Lance under his wing and teach him? And I think ultimately it was the exact opposite. And Lance was not cold towards Felipe, and Felipe wasn't necessarily cold towards Lance, but there wasn't symmetry. There wasn't chemistry between the two of them, and they were basically doing their own thing. And I think even with Sergio Perez is a terrific driver, and he's won himself a seat with Red Bull next season. But I also don't think he was in a position to mentor and tutor Lance because he was too busy trying to retain his own seat and be a competitive driver. But I think the expectations to Vettel were very clear that, hey, we want you to come in, we want you to compete, but we also want you to help develop and nurture Lance. And I just think that's part of the deal and part of the expectation. So what I'm curious to see is, how did the two of them interact off the track? Because we've never really seen that with Sergio and Lance. We certainly never saw that with Felipe and Lance. I'll be very curious to see how the two of them interact. Because the other thing I get from Lance as well, and I was listening to this on the BBC Checkered Flag podcast a couple of weeks ago, is they were talking about that Lance, it's not that he's not approachable. It's not that he isn't accessible. And it's not that he's not willing to have a conversation. It's just that it's hard to get anything out of him in terms of energy and passion. And I've listened to some Lance interviews in the past, and they can be a really difficult listen. And he's not trying to be disingenuous or disrespectful to the person interviewing him. It's just his personality. So I'm really excited to see whether there's chemistry with him and Vettel from the very beginning.
Yeah. You know, also your point about all the investment and everything that Lawrence Stroll has put into the team, he's put everything around around Lance now to help make him successful. But I think ultimately, if push comes to shove and he feels that, the decision comes that, for the betterment of the team, that he has to sever ties with Lance, I don't think he would ultimately... I think he would make that call if he needed to.
I completely agree.
The thing is that obviously the relationship that they have as father son is that that leash that sort of grace period is obviously going to be a little bit longer. But perhaps there's been some quiet father son moments, and this is obviously pure speculation on my part. Perhaps Lawrence has already said that to him. Lance, if it ever comes to that, I'll have to cut you loose, but don't put me in that position. We put all these things around you. But, getting Sebastian into the team, I think it does a lot of things. It helps Lance. It helps the team. It helps the team marketing because, he's bringing all that experience. He's bringing, 4 world championships with him. And I see just like we talked about a couple of weeks ago, that I just see a lot of positive reasons for bringing Sebastian Vettel into the team in the short term. How it works out over the medium and the long term is completely up to Sebastian Vettel and what he does in the year or two, whatever the term of his contract is.
The other, and I completely agree with everything you're saying. I think the one other thing of note that I would add from that Andrew Benson interview with mm-hmm. Lawrence is he made a couple of really good observations. One of which is something we've talked about before. We talked about with the introduction of the cost cap coming in that some of these bigger teams like Mercedes and Ferrari are going to be forced to reduce their headcount. And he spoke to the fact that even with the cost cap, Aston Martin's going to be in a position where they can continue to add a little bit more headcount. And I think that was a really astute observation. Mm-hmm. But he also spoke as well, and I don't want to get too far off track here, but he also spoke to the fact that he's really challenged Andrew Green and Otmar with continuing to develop this car, implementing their policy of buying the gearbox and some of the other core components. So I think they have a pretty good framework. The new factory's open. They're still in a position where they can build their headcount and continue to add people capital to the organization. And who knows, there may be some great people available when Mercedes and Ferrari have to make some really difficult decisions. But I'm excited to, obviously excited to see this team. But I also agree with you that Lawrence is an incredibly good business person. He's mm-hmm. amassed billions of dollars worth of wealth through his own business acumen. Yeah. And I don't think he is going to compromise his investment in Aston Martin or this Formula One team if he gets a sense that Lance isn't capable of competing at the highest level.
Yeah.
And I think the pressure will start to mount on Lance this coming season if he doesn't string together those consecutive really good performances.
Yeah, absolutely. I was going to just, I had another thing sort of pop into my head and, it's gone in one ear and out to the other. So why don't we just take one final break away here and maybe in the meantime, this brilliant thought I had will reappear, or perhaps it's just lost for the ages. Anyways, time for one final break here on the podcast is always up to speed with Formula One. We'll be back in just a moment. All right. Well, welcome back to the show. And sadly, that brilliant thought that I had hasn't reappeared. So let's just move on.
But that's the problem with, and I don't mean to interrupt, that's the problem with both of us, right? Is when we have our conversations, it's like you talk for a block of 15 minutes, then I talk for a block of 15 minutes. And while you're talking, like I'm frantically writing down notes because I'm like, oh, I need to bring this up. I need to bring this up. I need to bring this up. So I think as good as we are chemistry-wise, I think that's the challenge is we both like to have these long, kind of long-winded blocks of dialogue.
Yeah, it's one of those things. I don't keep notes while we're doing the show. I do all my notes beforehand before we start recording, but unfortunately it just seems to be one of those things that if I don't get it out right away, it's just going to disappear. But anyways, one thing that didn't disappear is that you hinted to it just in the previous segment was that Aston Martin has just announced their new title sponsor for 2021, and the fact that they're dropping the pink livery that we've seen the past couple of years as Racing Point, and it couldn't be anything other than British Racing Green for Aston Martin. I mean, we just have to be, it would be like Ferrari not being Scarlet Red. It'd be like Mercedes not being Silver, although the black worked very well, I must admit. But the British Racing Green, absolutely the right call. Can't wait to see what this car looks like at the launch in a couple of weeks.
Yeah, so it's February. I've got the date in my calendar because I'm extremely excited. And it's interesting too, because there are a couple of different variations on the British racing green theme. Jaguar has one of their own, which is much, much darker. It's kind of like a fern green, which I really don't like. Mm-hmm. But I absolutely adore the variation that Aston Martin uses. It's a lighter, it's a more... I don't know how to say it. It's a brighter color, but I cannot wait to see it on the car. And I also can't wait to see it on the merchandise and the racing gear. And I think mm-hmm. they're going to do very, very well from obviously a marketing perspective. And like you said, you know what? They have a new principal sponsor as well. So, the pink is gone. They're stepping into the big leagues. It only makes sense that they're going to partner with one of the world's biggest IT solutions providers. Am I saying it right? Cognizant? It's
yes.
Cognizant, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So that'll be worn principally along both sides of the car on the side pods. It will be strewn across the chest of the drivers, but it's going to be a really good look. And the other great thing too is that Aston Martin has really been teasing us ever since New Year's Day, right? Like they updated their social media. We've seen a few kind of snippets. Like we saw a photo of the new signage at the entrance to their factory at Silverstone. We've seen some headshots of Lance and Sebastian wearing the uniform, but we can't really see much lower than their neck, but we can see the collar and we can see the green. So they're teasing us, but I can't wait to see what this is ultimately going to look like. I think it's going to be an absolutely classic take on an incredibly historic racing team. And as a good reference point as well, because I had to go and look this up, as much as we associate Aston Martin with racing cars and hypercars and performance cars and that side of the motorsports industry, mm-hmm. They haven't competed in Formula One officially since 1960. So this will be the 60th anniversary of the last time that they competed as a works team. So it should be very, very exciting. And they're doing it, again, we talked a lot about this last couple of weeks, that from a road car perspective, there's been a great deal of integration with Mercedes, because developing power units and engines for road cars is equally as resource intensive as developing power units for Formula One cars. So they have some real integration on the road car side, but we're going to continue to see some true integration on the Formula One side as well. But both sides are absolutely adamant that this is not a Mercedes B team, and it's not intended to be a Mercedes B team. There just happens to be a lot of symmetry and shared componentry between the two teams. But I can't wait, and I love the color.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. But, you know, I have to be completely upfront that as skeptical as I was when they announced a couple of years ago that they were going to go to, like, this pink paint scheme with the previous title sponsor, BWT, I thought, I don't know if that's going to work on a Formula One car, but I got to give them a shout out. I have to say, for me, I thought that the pink and white, I thought it actually worked. It's not nearly as good as the British Racing green, but in its own way, I thought it was okay. I completely agree.
Yeah. And I hope we can see another team potentially with that tie up at some point in the future, because I thought it looked fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. But much like yourself, you know, I've been looking at these teasers that they've been throwing out. I mean, their social media has been on point.
It's been great.
You know, to use a point, you know, sort of a pun tying into the racing point thing there. But they've been doing a really, really exceptional job, really, you know, driving the interest, you know, as we inch closer towards that release date. And it's going to look great. And like I was saying just a little while ago, that it's good to see the British Racing green on a team, just like it's good to see the silver on the Mercedes, the scarlet red on the Ferrari, but also the papaya on the McLarens. I'm not young, but I'm not old enough to remember, like, the McLarens from the 70s and whatnot. I mean, my first recollections of the McLarens in the mid-1980s with Ayrton Senna and Alan Prost when I was a kid was the orange and the white of the Marlboro branding. And that's, you know, from the 80s, 90s, you know, up until maybe about 5-6 years ago, definitely since the whole tobacco thing has gone out. I mean, those couple of decades, paint schemes were largely dependent on, you know, the title sponsor, right? I mean, I'm wearing a Williams hat here from, about 20 years ago when their title sponsor, one of their main sponsors was HP. So HP's colors are blue and white. I mean, coincidentally the same colors as his hat. But I mean, I kind of like the idea that, okay, well, you can work your sponsors like colors into it, as you know, the BWT and the pink and everything worked out really well. But I like the historical colors, and I like them, you know, they're just rich. There's a heritage, there's all the history involved with it. And I think that the grid ultimately looks better for it.
Yeah, I completely agree.
All right, well, let's move over from one rebranded team to another, and I'm hoping maybe you can speak a little bit to this. And this is Renault, which is now Alpine F1, and the fact that Suzuki's MotoGP team has confirmed the departure of team boss Davide Brivio, and the big rumor is that he's going to Formula One to become something at Alpine.
So welcome to MotoGP Corner with Mark Hamilton. For those of you that don't know, and I'm going to set this up, I am a monster MotoGP fan. I don't do a MotoGP podcast because I don't know that there's anyone in North America that would listen, but I love MotoGP. And I think, and I'm not going to get really into the weeds when it comes to the sport, but there's a lot of parallels between MotoGP and Formula One. The calendars are very similar. There's a lot of overlap in the circuits. All of the teams have two drivers. There's a team championship. There's a rider championship. There's a lot of symmetry there. So there has been speculation for a few weeks that Alpine, formerly Renault, is looking to completely reboot the leadership structure on the Formula One team. So the CEO of Renault Group is a gentleman named by the name of Luca Di Meo. Was it Di Meo? Di Meo?
Di Meo, yeah, I think so, yeah.
Sometimes let's go with Luca Di Meo.
Yeah.
So he is, and this is, I think, one of the things that's really beneficial to the Formula One project at Renault. This is a guy who has a fairly rich history with motorsport himself. And I think that helped the cause, because I think there's been questions within that Nissan-Renault alliance over the last couple of years about whether this is a project they want to continue with. Mm-hmm. Fortunately, they do, and they're putting some real energy into the rebranded Alpine Group. And what they've done is they've gone to the factory Suzuki team in MotoGP and lured away their team manager, David Brivio. And this is a guy who has been an absolute sensation in MotoGP. So he was a part of, he's been a part of the MotoGP family, or the Suzuki MotoGP family, since 2011. So historically, Suzuki's always had a presence in MotoGP. They left for a while. They returned officially in 2015. He was there from the inception to help build that team. Again, they were starting from scratch. They had to start completely over. New bike, new engine, recruiting drivers, engineers, everything. So he was intimately involved in that process. And the distinction of MotoGP in Formula One is that MotoGP teams are much, much, much smaller. So if you make a bad hire, it has a real impact on your team. So he was able to bring together the squad, and they had some initial successes in the first couple of years. But this year, they had a shock win. Their principal rider won the championship, the Riders' Championship, and they also won the team championship. So this was an absolute sensation in the MotoGP world. Now, if you follow MotoGP, you understand that, hey, Marc Marquez was out, and this would be the equivalent of Hamilton getting injured in the second or third race of the season and missing the entire campaign. Really, things were wide open, but they absolutely took advantage of that, and they won the team championship and the Riders' Championship. Now, his past prior to joining the Suzuki team was back in the first decade of the 2000s. He was a part of the factory Yamaha team, and he was the individual that engineered the move that brought Valentino Rossi from the factory Honda team to the factory Yamaha team, where he subsequently won four titles in the next 6 or 7 years. So he has been a sensation. But while he was at Yamaha, also at Yamaha was Luca Di Meo. So the two of them have worked together in the past. Luca knows what his capabilities are. Luca knows that he's great at building chemistry and putting together a really functional organization. But he also knows he's really good at taming and managing high-profile personalities in the cockpit or on the bike. So the thought is that this is going to be somebody that can not only put together the infrastructure of the team and manage the team, but somebody who can manage a high-profile driver. So there's a lot of things here at play, but I think this is a terrific move. And I think the only people that are potentially shocked by this are the Suzuki team. They didn't necessarily see this coming by all accounts, but it had been speculated and rumored for at least the last couple of weeks in the Formula One press. So I think this is sensational. So he'll be joining Alpine as the new CEO of the Formula One operation. So incredibly excited. And if you get the chance, look up some of his interviews on YouTube. He's got a phenomenal personality. He's friendly. He's outgoing. He's got lots of humor. Really, really excited to see this.
Yeah, it's really kind of interesting because Renault, over the past several years, I don't want to say that they've been an out-and-out disappointment, but they certainly have fall short of expectations.
Maybe I'm being too nice.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the thing is, when they announced that they were going to be coming in and taking over the Lotus team, they're coming back in, I was really excited because, I mean, we all know the success that they've had previously. I mean, Fernando won his two world championships with Renault back in 05 and 06. And I mean, this is a team and a manufacturer that's been in it on both sides as a manufacturer, as a work team in their own right, and as an engine supplier. And they've had success in previous incarnations and outings in Formula One. And they've just consistently over the past several years after taking over Lotus that, of course, there was going to be that sort of in-between time when they re-stamped that that Lotus team and made it their own. And I expected there would be a little bit of a lag, but they've fallen well short of the mark. And there was obvious that something needed to be done. And I was quite worried there for a while that perhaps that even before COVID, you know, there was talks that perhaps that they weren't going to stay in Formula One for the long run. But when they announced that they were committed, that they were going to stay, and this is something that they're actually committed to, my next question was, okay, now what? Okay, so you're in Formula One, but you can't keep going that the way that you're going. I mean, you're either in, you're going to do it to 110%, or you're just going to kind of make up the numbers like you have since 2015 or whatever it is, which is basically, you know, middle of the team or middle of the pack kind of team that really hasn't shown anything other than maybe a complete fluke of circumstances that would be their only real shot at getting on a podium in a race like Turkey, for example, that we saw this year when everything was flipped on side of upside down because of the rain and the slippery track and all that. So it definitely is interesting, and I'm looking forward to seeing what's going on, and how this is going to manifest itself. I mean, they got a new team principal, Marcin Budkowski. So very, very interesting times there. And of course, car is going to look completely different for this year in terms
And the one thing I would add, and you made such a great point, for me, the biggest thing about Renault since they've re-entered the sport as a works team is it just felt like they lacked identity.
Yeah.
And it kind of felt like it's been a churn of drivers, a churn of leaders. It's been, despite the fact that they had all that immense success when they were partnered up with Red Bull in 2010, 11, 12, 13, none of that ever seemed to translate. And it seemed like every time Renault was in the news, it was because of a dispute with Red Bull. And it was, nothing has ever been favorable for them. And they've really lacked that identity. And I think the rebrand helps because they can kind of wash away all of that. And they're going to rebrand in the French national colors. So white, red, and blue. They're bringing in an exceptional CEO who's demonstrated in the past that he can build a winner and he can tame really strong personalities. I think to your point, having a new team principal is good at this point. Like I'm excited to see what's capable or what's possible here, because I think the last 4 or 5 years have been, I don't want to say it's been a waste, but it's just lacked identity. And I don't know what the returns for Renault have been by operating that team. So again, very, very interested to see what can happen next year. And I'm not expecting that to come out necessarily next year and win races, but they did crack a couple of podiums this year, and I wasn't expecting that. So maybe there's something from a foundational perspective that they're going to be able to build on. Because the good news is that for Davide and the new team principal is they're not starting from scratch. There's some foundational work that's been done.
Yeah.
Obviously, I think that a lot of the work this year is going to be immersing Alonso with that team and that car and taming the personality and making sure that he delivers both on the track and off the track. But yeah, it's interesting. It's very, very interesting to see what that team's going to look like.
Well, you know, before we wind up the show here in a minute, Mark, I just want to say that I'm sure you're completely... off in your estimations here, all the money that they must have missed out in terms of, points in the Constructors' Championship over the past couple of years, you know they were just raking it in with all that Julian Palmer merch that they've been selling, So you lose that on one side, but you're just raking it in on the other.
I've got at least 3 Julian shirts. What about you?
At least 4. But before I get into my Julian Palmer hat collection, so there you go. And on that note, with a bizarre and unexpected Julian Palmer reference that wasn't even in the offing 3 minutes ago, but the new normal, anything goes now, and it has done for some time. And on that note, my friend, that's all I got for this week.
Yeah, me too.
You too.
I mean, the reality is, I think we've done a really good job of putting aside all of the really horrific things that have been happening in the world, in the U.S. Capitol. And hopefully this has been a really good distraction for our listeners so they could kind of put on their headphones, go for a run, go for a drive, and catch up on the things that are going on in the world of Formula One. And my sense is there's going to be a ton of additional news next week as well. There's a lot of stuff bubbling below the surface. And there's 4 or 5 stories that we could have touched on today, but we'll probably save those. And we'll see how the Hamilton saga plays out with Mercedes. But yeah, we'll be back next week with much, much more.
Yeah, and if you want a special shout out on the show, tweet us your ultimate selfie and your Julian Palmer kit and let us see it at Scuderia F1 Pod. And I know right now we're not going to see too many selfies with the hashtag Julian Rocks, but we should stop being mean. He doesn't deserve it. But anyways, on that note, all joking aside, and I have nothing against Julian Palmer. I'm just being cruel for no reason. If you want to get in touch with us, easiest way, as I just mentioned, on Twitter at Scuderia F1 Pod or email us at ScuderiaF1Pod@gmail.com. And that's it. On behalf of myself and my co-host and friend, Mark Hamilton, thank you for listening. Have a great week, and we'll talk to you guys again very, very soon. Bye for now.